Thanks for joining us. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Federal investigators have begun sorting through evidence related to last week's horrific attack that killed 13 people and wounded 38 at Fort Hood in Texas, including ties the army psychiatrist suspected of the shootings may have had with a radical cleric. Joining me in the studio to talk about some of the many questions being raised, Dana Priest, investigative reporter for The Washington Post, Imam Yahya Hendi, Muslim chaplain at Georgetown University and the National Naval Medical Center, and retired Major General Paul Eaton. He's a senior advisor at National Security Network. Thank you all very much for joining me.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
And we will be opening the phones later on in the program. 1-800-433-8850 is the phone number. You can also send questions and comments via email, of course, to drshow@wamu.org. Before we get to the phones and to my guests in the studio, we're joined also by Yoki Driesen. He's a military correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Yoki, thank you so much for joining the Diane Rehm Show.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
A lot of news coming out on this investigation this morning. Can you just give us a quick update of where we stand?
Yeah, I mean, the investigation has really focused, has sharpened its focus very heavily, not just on Major Hassan broadly, but on the kind of somewhat explosive question of whether his religion played a role in the attack. And that can be shorthanded down somewhat improperly, because really that has two separate components to it. One is if he had been in contact with anyone overseas who may have either indirectly or directly encouraged the attack or provided any kind of advice on how to carry it out. A second related question is, even if that did not happen, did his own belief system change and did his own thoughts become more radicalized for some other reason, which may have led him on his own to carry out the attack without any outside help whatsoever? So the investigation is pursuing both tracks under this broader rubric of whether his religious beliefs or his political beliefs or a combination of the two led to the attack.
Okay, and the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs now is planning to investigate the shootings. And in particular, Yoki, they're going to be looking at the links, as you've suggested, between Major Hassan and somebody abroad. And the person they're looking at is Anwar al-Awlaki, who was an American-born Muslim prayer leader preaching in Virginia and is now living in Yemen. Is that right?
That is. And what's come out in the last day or so is that there had been emailed communications back and forth between the two men dating back some time that had been intercepted by U.S. intelligence agencies and evaluated. And at the time, the conclusion was that they were somewhat benign and that there was no reason to carry out any further investigation. The FBI has since announced that it's going to conduct a self-evaluation to see if it was handled correctly. The military, meanwhile, faces a somewhat different question, which is, was that information, the fact that a serving U.S. Army major was communicating with someone considered to be a Muslim radical, was that communicated to the Pentagon? And if so, what was done with it? Those questions have not yet been answered, but in some ways those are the more explosive ones yet to be answered.
Okay, Yoki, if you could stay with us, I'm going to bring our panel in on the state of play of the investigation. Dana Priest, you have a front page story this morning on the Washington Post talking about these links, but also talking about a speech that Major Hassan gave in Walter Reed, in which he seemed to suggest that there would be threats within the ranks if Muslim soldiers serving in the U.S. military were not able to get themselves out of the military rather than serving in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Right. He did this briefing in June of 07, in his final year as a resident at Walter Reed. All residents in that year have to present a medical research paper and presentation to the staff there. And instead of choosing a medical topic, he wrote about Islam and the implications for the U.S. military. It's a 50-page briefing. He did an hour presentation. And when you read the whole thing, he really is giving them a warning. He's saying that to have Muslims fight other Muslims overseas is going to cause you trouble, could possibly result in what he says are adverse effects. And within the paper, he describes adverse effects as he gives some of the cases where, there has been some violence against troops. So he really is cautioning, and he says he finds that he's making a recommendation at the end, the only way to deal with this is first to identify Muslim soldiers who are having conflicts with their religion because of the wars, and then to allow them to leave, he doesn't say the service, but allow them to be conscientious objectors and to leave positions where they would be put into fighting or killing other Muslims. And that this is a conflict that cannot be resolved by the individual by themselves.
You've seen this document. You've read it. Do you know what the reaction of the people in the room was to his presentation? How much concern was there? I'm sort of linking this back to what Yoki was saying about concern of the contacts that Major Hassan might have had.
Well, first of all, I think the document now is at WashingtonPost.com, so everybody can read it. The reaction was people were angry that he had taken a medical assignment and turned it into this. What we don't know is whether the physicians there then reported him in any way to other authorities. I have to say the Army in particular has a fairly large, and it's grown a lot since 9/11, they would call it an insider threat counterintelligence apparatus. And you've seen nowhere in any of these reportings that it was involved in this. So I have to sort of ask, you know, where were they? But on the other hand, this is a very sensitive subject because the Army does consider itself open to all, and it welcomes, especially now when it's trying to understand Muslims, welcoming people from the Muslim faiths. So they don't want to just assume that because someone is speaking of such things that they themselves are considering this or are extremists on their own. So it's a touchy thing to figure out at what point do you hand this over to investigators.
Okay, Imam Hendi, you have met with the man who is alleged to have been the gunman in these attacks, Major Hassan. How did you know him, and what does what you've been hearing about the talk that he gave at Walter Reed, how does that fit in with how you knew him?
Sure. Well, to start with, I really want to tell you and everyone who is listening to us that as a Muslim and as an American Muslim, I condemn the act of the shooting and consider it to be very tragic, very sad, heartbreaking, and must not be accepted. Muslims worldwide and nationwide here in America have to speak with one voice against the shooting and against what happened. I felt and still feel sad and heartbroken because I spoke at Fort Hood a few times to train our soldiers before they deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. So I feel also some connection to our soldiers over there in Killeen, Texas. I serve as a contract Muslim chaplain at the National Naval Medical Center, where I have been for about 13 years, and have come across Muslim soldiers and sailors, especially in the capacity of teaching, leading services, or counseling. I cannot exactly recall how many times I met with him, never person-to-person, face-to-face, one-on-one, except he came to my services a few times in the last few years. Once I remember I gave a speech in condemnation of extremism and exclusivity within the Muslim community. I made a remark about the mullahs of Pakistan being the number one danger for Pakistan and for Islam, and how we have to stand and voice our opinion against the mullahs of Pakistan. And he came across after the ceremony and told me how pleased he was with what I said. He believed, according to what he told me then, in almost a minute and a half, how he also supports that idea that extremism has no voice, has no place in Islam, and must not be accepted, and that Muslims with one voice have to speak against extremism in the name of Islam.
Imam Hendi, when did this exchange take place?
I don't remember, to say the truth, but I do remember it happened in the last few years.
Major General Paul Eaton, what questions, picking up on what Dana Priest has been saying and what Yoki Driessen told us at the beginning of the program, what questions do you think the military should be focusing on right now?
Sure. Kadi, my heartfelt sorrow to the victims, to their families, and and to the entire United States Army as they work their way through this problem. The real question is, what do great units, what do great organizations do when something really bad happens? And the first thing is you take care of the families. You take care of the survivors, and you provide the most dignified resolution that you can. And the chain of command out at Fort Hood will do a superb job. The second thing you do is, how did it happen? And you work your way through the investigation in a completely impartial fashion. And we do this really well in the military. Anytime you have an aircraft accident, anytime you have a serious event, the postmortem that follows is detailed, it is impartial, and it is very rigorous.
So you think the questions that are being asked now about the kinds of contacts he had with people abroad, with this imam abroad, the speech that he gave at Walter Reed, all of this is an important part of the investigation into what happened?
Absolutely. The Army, and we've discussed already, the interagency process will do their due diligence.
Dana Priest, can you bring us up to date a little bit more on these contacts he had with the imam in Yemen? Do you know exactly how many there were, exactly what the nature of them were, what he wrote in those emails?
Well, only that they were less than a dozen, fewer than a dozen, and didn't appear to be soliciting advice for action or anything like that, because the investigators who have looked at these emails at the time they were intercepted, presumably because they were looking at the imam over in Yemen, were not worried about it and said that they were consistent with the sort of research that he was doing. Now, we don't really know what that is. Apparently, he was working on a thesis that
on post-traumatic stress.
On post-traumatic stress, but focused on his community, I believe.
Okay, we'll come back after this short break with more of your questions and comments to our panel looking at the latest in the investigation in Fort Hood, Texas. The phone number here, 8.50. Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined our conversation on the latest in the investigations of what happened at Fort Hood in Texas last week, those terrible shootings. I'm joined in the studio by Dana Priest. She's an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Imam Hendi is here. He's the Muslim chaplain at Georgetown University and also at the National Naval Medical Center. We have retired Major General Paul Eaton. He's a senior advisor with the National Security Network. And we have on the phone with us Yoki Driessen, military correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Yoki, I just wanted to get more of what we were talking about with Dana just before the break about exactly the contacts that Major Hassan had with Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen, what we know about those contacts, what kind of red flags they raised. They were dropped as part of an investigation because they were felt to be innocuous. Is there now some revision of that theory? And I think we don't have Yoki Driessen perhaps on the phone, so let's...
I'm here.
Okay, Yoki, did you hear that question?
Yeah, I did. As far as I've been picking up, there isn't a revision of the belief that the substance of those emails was not particularly alarming. What there is more concern about is the sheer existence of them. In other words, they were looked at, the people I've talked to who are familiar with them, and you know, those are people who are one step removed, so I put that out as a caveat, but they say there was nothing in them that was suggestive of extremist thought. There's nothing in them that was in any way, shape, or form suggestive of planning an attack or seeking advice or a blessing for an attack. But in retrospect, the question is, did the simple fact that they were picked up 10 or 20 times, should that have prompted the army to do more? Should that have prompted the army to red flag Major Hassan, to perhaps not promote him, to perhaps not move him to a different base, and most importantly, to perhaps not make plans to deploy him to Afghanistan, since it does appear that regardless of what other his belief system, that the imminent deployment to Afghanistan may have been the event that triggered this rampage.
And Yoki, we should be clear, and I think it's absolutely worth clarifying again, that nobody is suggesting that Major Hassan was working in coordination with, was being directed by, was being aided by any terrorist organization.
No, that's exactly right, and it is an important point to underline. And, you know, in some ways, one person I was talking to made the argument that it would be an easier thing for the military to accept if the reverse had been the case. I mean, if Major Hassan had been someone who was actively in discussions with a terrorist cell overseas, that's a problem that, to a degree, we have some experience in dealing with, that to a degree is something that has been the reality of this country for the last 6, 7, 8 years, you know, that as a possibility. If, however, this is something different, where it was someone who was not in contact, was not part of a sleeper cell, was not seeking advice or a blessing, but instead just had his belief system radicalized on its own for some other reason, in some ways that's more alarming because it's a much harder thing to anticipate or to try to pick up signs of it happening.
Before the shootings last week, Yoki, you had written about concerns that people had about the psychological stress of members of the military and their families. What in particular have those concerns been, and have they been growing?
Yeah, the concerns have been largely about PTSD. I mean, the concerns have been that the constant tours to a war that has no front line, in which, you know, fighting people in civilian clothing, often with civilian casualties, is part of the fighting and part of the norm of life there, that the constant rotation of going to those types of war zones, one tour, second tour, third tour, fourth tour, that it's causing a psychological break on the part of many members of the armed forces. I mean, you've seen a really alarming spike in alcohol use and drug use, in divorces and in suicide, and also in, although it's harder to measure, anecdotally at least, in crimes committed by returning veterans. So there is a concern that the psychological burden of having done so many tours in such a difficult war is beginning to lead to really negative outcomes back in the States, ranging from divorce on one end of the spectrum to suicide or homicide on the other end. Major Hassan obviously had not deployed, so he himself would not have had PTSD. From his work, from being someone who treated those who did have it, he was certainly aware of the realities of that war and the horrors of that war and the kind of damage it could do to a person's psyche and soul.
Yoki, I have a panel full of people nodding their heads. Dana Priest, you want to pick up on
that?
Well,
one of the key factors to be that's yet known, yet unknown, is whether or not he actually did apply for conscientious objector status and what the Army did with that. It would not have been something they would have wanted to give him because he's so highly trained. They need psychiatrists so badly. They need Muslim psychiatrists who are going to understand, other Muslim soldiers and help the Army understand a culture that they really do not understand. But again, going back to this briefing, he's really saying this is my recommendation, that there are going to be soldiers who are so conflicted about this that they cannot carry out that job. Now, did he ask before, or when he found out he was going to be deployed, did he ask to leave, to get released from going over there, is I think a really interesting question. And how did the Army deal with that?
Imam Hendi, in your capacity as somebody who is counseling people in the military, Muslims in the military, how much conflict are you hearing from those who you are talking to?
No, by the way, we do not counsel as a Muslim chaplain. I do not counsel only Muslims. I counsel any sailor or any soldier who comes towards me or to me, often in inter-religious marriages. I have heard a lot of pain, people concerned about divorce, marital issues, people who do not want to go back to fighting, people who can no longer sleep the way they used to, people who lost communication with their spouses, with their children. And this is nothing, it's not related only to Muslims, but also to non-Muslims. I have heard from both sides.
What about the particular point that Dana Priest was picking up on in reference to Major Hassan's briefing at Walter Reed, that there were particular stresses for Muslims in the U.S. military going to fight in Muslim countries? Is that something you're hearing as well?
You know, I have heard, not as many times as people suggest, actually. And every time a soldier came to me or a sailor, my answer was, well, in Islam you don't fight, period, except in self-defense. And that's what militaries do. They fight in self-defense. The moment you sign on becoming a soldier in the U.S. military, you sign on defending America, your country, my country, our country. I also pointed a lot to the issue of that Iraq and Iran were engaged in a war for many, many years, Muslims fighting Muslims. And therefore, that I said many times that this fight for us is not against Muslims. It's against extremists, against terrorists, and we have to win the war for the benefit of the world, for the benefit of America, but also for the benefit of Islam.
Major General Paul Eaton, you have said before that the Army has for years been under-resourced for the needs of soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. What we're talking about this morning has religious components, it has psychological components, but it is also about a military that is very overstretched.
That is certainly the case. And first I'd like to address one of the things that the Imam said. The King of Jordan, Abdullah, has asked all the military in Jordan to wear a pin with the Jordanian flag with the number one superposed. And it's not we're number one, it is Jordan first, above ethnicity, above religion, above family, above tribe. So it really does go to that point. With respect to chronic shortages, particularly in the medical arena, we were unprepared for the casualty rate that we've sustained over the last 8 years. And we're still trying to catch up from that. And our failure to prepare adequately in the beginning is still current. General Lynch the other day, actually a few months ago now, testified before Congress that he was 44 psychiatric assistance personnel short in his organization. And that's just one place. So we have a serious and sustained shortage of medical personnel, particularly those who are trained to deal with the PTSD.
And it looks like at Fort Hood we have a particularly intense case of this. We have the highest amount of deployment to Afghanistan and Iraq. We also have the highest suicide rate.
Fort Hood is a huge organization, and they have deployed often and with great success. The chain of command there is more than conscious of the stressors that they have, but we need to come on board and help them out.
One of the reasons that that Major Hassan was sent to Fort Hood was that he was underproductive at Walter Reed, and they didn't want to send him to a post where there weren't a lot of colleagues around who could keep an eye on him. And they purposely sent him to Fort Hood because there was a large number of psychiatrists who could make sure that he was, working as he should. And so that's one of the reasons, in fact, that he went to that particular job.
General Eaton, what more could the administration, could the Army be doing to try to mitigate some of the stress factors that we're seeing with rising suicide rates, as the Imam was saying, concerns about divorce, marital problems?
The administration is well underway to rectify some of the sins of the past. And the recruitment rate, the growing the force, growing particularly the specialty arenas that we need to cover down on current shortages. The administration also did something terrific when they appointed General Shinseki as the director for the Veterans Administration. You have in that particular general the most admired retired four-star that I can think of.
I wanted to add a point about how I participated, as I said earlier, in a training for soldiers before they deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. And this happened almost 2 years after September, after the war in Iraq started, because the military realized that we knew very little about the culture of Islam, the culture of Muslims, the culture of Iraqis and Afghanis. And they institutionalized that training to help synthesize, help prepare our soldiers before deployment to Iraq and Afghanistan. And therefore, I give the credit to the military that they tried their best to train, to educate, to prepare our soldiers before deployment.
Yoki Driessen, one thing we learned after 9/11 was the need for intelligence agencies to cooperate with each other and to communicate with each other. From the research and the reporting that you have done on this case, was there satisfactory communication between all the different agencies, between everyone that needed to know him? It seems to me that we have Dana Priest's story from this morning about this address he gave in Walter Reed. Was somebody putting all the pieces of the puzzle together, linking that to his contacts with the radical Imam in Yemen?
That is right now the absolutely most important question, both for the journalists on the outside looking at this, but also, frankly, for the Army and FBI investigators on the inside looking at this. And right now there isn't an easy answer. It certainly does seem as if there were signs that were missed. You know, the email exchange with Imam Al-Awlaki in Yemen may not have, in the substance of the emails, needed to have been further investigated. But it's very far from clear that the Army was even alerted to the intercepts of those emails, let alone that on the Walter Reed side, as Dana's piece this morning showed, it's not clear that anyone at Walter Reed took those concerns and sent them up the Army chain to the Army's criminal investigators or to the Army's own kind of counterterror division. So there's one set of questions kind of internal to the Army about whether even within the kind of broader Army universe these concerns were raised. There's a separate question about outside the Army, did the FBI and the NSA and the CIA and whoever else may have been intercepting these emails, did they share them? Right now there are no signs that they did, so that is the source of the deepest concern and the highest priority in investigation.
I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850 and send an email to drshow with your questions and comments at wmu.org. Let's go to Kendall in Washington State. Kendall, you had direct contact with Major Hassan.
Yes, I did. First of all, I'd like to say that I don't condone what he did at all, and I definitely feel for the families. But on the same hand, I would also like to put a human face on this and try to get away from the big media spin because, you know, there's a lot of other things that are going on with soldiers all over the place that, you know, doesn't get so much attention. Now, obviously, what he did was horrific, but we need to look at the broader picture and look at him, at these actions as symptoms to a larger problem. I mean, this is an unwinnable war. You know, what are we doing? What's the goal? You know, we're changing administrations, but nothing's changing. You know, what is happening? People are frustrated, and it's a symptom of something that's not working.
Kendall, have you served in Afghanistan or Iraq?
Yes, I did. I spent 15 months in Iraq, and I spent almost 2 years at Walter Reed.
And what exactly? And the pressures that you're talking about, the kind of what you say is a symptom of a bigger problem. What pressures particularly do you feel the Army is not addressing?
Well, I mean, as a soldier, when you go to war, you do, you know, you're doing your job. You need to put your heart into it, and if you're unsure and you see things that aren't making sense, you start to lose your soul. And when you're requested to take actions that aren't justifiable, you know, you have to internalize that. And if you can't manage to internalize that, you struggle inside, and you have to deal with these issues. And it's hard from a personal perspective, and that's why I say we need to put a human face on this, because we are human.
And Kendall, sorry, just before you go, your contacts with Major Hassan, you were a patient of his. What kind of a man was he when you knew him?
I knew him as a very gentle man, very caring, and very helpful.
Okay. Kendall, thank you so much for calling into the Diane Rehm Show. Paul Eaton, the kinds of conflicts that we're hearing about there from Kendall, symptomatic of the kinds of stresses that people in the military are going for, and they don't feel that they are getting the support they need.
Well, the current Army and Marine Corps that we have right now, more so the Army, was not designed for the long war. We were designed to conduct short, violent combined arms operations to and quickly end the conflict. So what we have right now is a force under considerable load. We had a previous administration that refused to grow the force to meet the foreign policy demands that we have put upon the Army. And we've also failed in the interagency process to properly resource the armed forces with all those other examples of U.S. power projection to help unweight the United States Army and the Marine Corps. So the force is under load. It's under stress.
Dana, you were nodding your head when you were listening to Kendall. You've heard these stories many times.
Well, I've talked to people at Walter Reed who knew Major Hassan, first of all, and do describe him as soft-spoken, gentle, a loner, someone who didn't make friends easily, didn't hang out with people. didn't express any radical views that they can recall. So it really does look like a person in transition and struggling with that. And as Kendall said, as these wars continue and there is question about, you know, why we are there still or what the actions need to be taken to get out, there are people are put in situations with increased civilian casualties and whatnot that are uncomfortable for them and that they do internalize, and that the army, it is trying to do things differently, but it is not only poorly resourced, although getting better in this area, but it's in a culture that traditionally supports strength and questions weakness. So culturally, it's a difficult thing to change.
Dana Priest is investigative reporter for The Washington Post. I've been joined also on the phone by Yoki Driesen from The Wall Street Journal. I have with me Imam Hendi from Georgetown University and the National Naval Medical Center. Retired Major General Paul Eaton is also with me from the National Security Network. Please stay with us for more on our conversations on this investigation.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. And by Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. This is NPR.
The British Secret Service opens its archives for the first time ever. MI5's successes and near misses, plus its infiltration by double agents. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined our conversation on the latest on the investigation of what happened in Fort Hood in Texas last week. I've got an email here from Sue in Bethesda. Sue writes to us, I have read that one of Major Hassan's problems, which could have contributed to triggering his breakdown, was that he was taunted by US military personnel for being a Muslim and therefore of questionable loyalty in this war. In asking this question, I'm not blaming the victim, but I do wonder to what extent military personnel in general are receptive to their Muslim colleagues and to what extent this could have contributed to Major Hassan's views. Imam Hendi.
You know, from my experience, I believe that the military is very clear in its support of its Muslims, very accommodating, very supportive financially, morally, in every way, shape, and form. We used to have no Muslim chaplain. I believe now we have 12 Muslim chaplains serving in the U.S. military. You drive into the National Naval Medical Center and you see the crescent next to the Star of David and the cross. I believe they are very supportive. I do not recall of any case where I was told, Imam Hendi, you cannot do this, you cannot do that. Actually, they're very supportive of me being there in support of Muslim sailors and soldiers.
Major General Eaton, one of the concerns, of course, of the U.S. military now in the light of what happened in Fort Hood is that there will be some kind of backlash against U.S. military service personnel, and they are being very careful, the Army, to separate his religion and his religious inclinations from what happened in Fort Hood and from this investigation.
Well, you can try to separate it, but it's very difficult to get that done throughout the force. In the early 70s, I was a platoon leader and company commander, and we had a black-white problem. And what we did, we didn't tiptoe around it. We confronted it. We brought everybody together. We said, what is it that makes you angry about the other guy and a different race? So it was high confrontation, and I had a great gift in First Sergeant Charlie Wilson and his wife Peggy, who helped me and my wife as we negotiated our way through the racial dramas of the early 70s. So you can't tiptoe around this thing. It's just get it out in the open, work it out, talk to both sides, and get feelings on the table. Otherwise, it's just going to fester, and you're not going to get anywhere in the solution process.
I have a question from Graham in Berlin, Germany, who writes to us, why couldn't the major simply resign?
The investigation, I think, is going to inform that. The simple resignation is a difficult process, so I cannot presume to get into the middle of that investigation.
Well, also he was obligated to serve until 2017 because the military, the government, had paid for all of his education, so he could not resign. He had to pay back by serving as a psychiatrist.
Let's go to Jeff in Farmland, Indiana. Jeff, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I just recently lost my son to suicide while I was home on leave and everything from Afghanistan. And after watching the things about Fort Hood and everything, the tremendous amount of stress these men are under and everything, and I'm just hoping that, you know, nobody just overreacts and says this is just a Muslim thing, and we get down to the bare roots of what actually happened. I mean, because the military doesn't need to have, you know, the extra stress of not being able to look at their soldiers and wander and guys watching their back because they're serving with Muslims in the military.
Jeff, I'm so sorry for your loss. Thank you for calling into the program. You have raised a very good point about the levels of stress that the military needs to look at in the light of what happened with your son and, of course, what happened in Fort Hood as well. Dana Priest.
Well, I think that's why you've seen right from the beginning strong statements by people speaking with the media saying you can't make broad generalizations from this. You see today again they're saying there's just no indication that he was part of any other network or group. And the message there and the message that I think we'll see in the future is just what he's saying, that you cannot condemn every Muslim serving in the military, and we need to have that force, have the diversity. And, of course, they're ready for a backlash. Well, I'm sure they are expecting them because there is prejudice, not just against Muslims, but against others within the military. People, I've been around a lot of troops, and they tend to, you know, they're still black and white soldiers tend to eat together in the mess halls. It's just like, you know, the bigger society. So the problems there are magnified because of the intensity of the experience, but it's not that different from society as a whole.
And again, we send our condolences to Jeff in Indiana.
And I do as well, sir. I cannot imagine going through that as a parent. And I will tell you that the Army, even though it's under stress, has handled the stress by becoming a far more cohesive force. And I have seen this cohesion get stronger over time. and you may be a Muslim soldier, but when you're in an infantry squad of 9 men, you're not a Muslim soldier in that infantry squad. You're a member of that squad, and you're a member of that family. So in the fabric of the Army, you are integrated, whatever your race, whatever your ethnicity or your religion. So you may be a Muslim soldier, and I got to repeat that, but when you're in that rifle squad, you're a member of that squad.
Let's go one second, Imam. We're going to go to Daniel in Norman, Arkansas. Daniel, thank you so much for joining the Diane Rehm Show.
Yes, thank you for receiving my call. The Quran can be interpreted in two ways. There are earlier and later verses. And Surah, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, 9:5, states, "Fight and slay the pagans wherever you find them, and seize them and beleaguer them and lie in wait for them in every stratagem of war. But if they repent and establish regular prayers and practice regular charity, then open the way for them, for Allah is oft forgiving, most merciful." So if they convert, then fine. If they don't, then kill them. Muslims should not be allowed in the U.S. military. I don't understand how, when this guy was mouthing off as he was, that he was retained even as a major. This is a recipe for disaster.
Daniel, sorry, I want to pick up on something you just said there. You were saying that Muslims should not be allowed in the U.S. military, full stop. Is that what you're suggesting?
Exactly.
I think that almost everybody in America would disagree with that proposition. And I'm going to open that up to our panel, because I can't believe that anybody would think that that was either legal, justified, sensible, or a rational course for America, for America's national security, to exclude one group of this population.
When, to start with, I want to say, my friend, you are misquoting the Quran. The Quran also talks about peace and compassion. In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate, a verse we read every time we open the Quran. Number two, we must not allow the diversity of our military and country become the victim of such a tragic event. Number three, Muslims have also fought in Iraq and in Afghanistan in the last few years, and they have died for their country, for our country, for the United States of America. And we will continue to fight in defense of America against extremism and against terrorism. That is my voice, the voice of American Muslims.
Major General.
One of the great strengths of the United States Armed Forces is that we are a true reflection of our society, and we've got to continue to be that. That was one of the building tenets as I started out to build the Iraqi Armed Forces, was that it would be truly reflective of Iraqi society. That gives you the true strength of your armed forces.
So excluding Muslims?
Certainly not.
Let's go to Nancy in Boca Raton, Florida. Nancy, thank you for joining the Diane Rehm Show. Nancy, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Early on in the process of admitting him to the Army as a psychiatrist, there was comment made that Hassan exhibited signs of being unfit for service, and especially in the psychiatric arena. And that it was, but because of the demands placed on the Army, that he was able to continue the program. And I'd like to know, why is there no common sense that enters into the equation in this regard?
Okay, let me put that to Dana Priest. Dana, have you heard anything about this in your reporting?
No, not unfit for service. And really, they were about to spend a lot of money on him, giving him a good education with the expectation that he would be a good psychiatrist, and they are in desperate need of psychiatrists, good ones. So it's that doesn't comport with any of the reporting that we found. The reporting that I've found does show that he was, at least at Walter Reed, one of the less productive residents there, and that people had concerns about that. He tried his hand at research in his fellowship the last year and really didn't do that well in that. However, he wasn't, as far as we know, he didn't have any malpractice problems, but we don't know that history. And there are ways to deal with that. There's a system in place to find incompetent people. Now, whether he was just a weak physician, you know, that is to be seen, too. But again, I just don't think the military would have graduated him and then passed him along if he were really unfit to serve.
Dana, we've seen over the years how very difficult it is to see when somebody crosses that Rubicon from being under emotional stress, which so many members of the military are, to getting to some kind of breaking point. Do you think the Army is any better equipped than society in general? Is it making advances in the kinds of things, the mechanisms it uses to spot that sort of red flag, to spot what you were talking about earlier, kind of transition moment?
Well, not to speak about him, but the larger force. Yes, they have made progress. It's not perfect by any means. We still hear a lot from soldiers who feel like they are not getting good psychiatric or counseling even. But they have, one of the things that they have done is put in place more mechanisms to evaluate people to begin with. And instead of just evaluating them right when they come back, they then reevaluate them several months later, because PTSD often does not show itself until several months after deployment's over. So they did recognize that that was a weakness in their system, and they have now put in place another evaluation. One of the most difficult things is, what do you do with someone who's in a unit, in the field, who shows signs of stress? And they have psychiatric units that are out in forward bases trying to evaluate people. Mainly what they end up doing, however, is if someone is really okay, you know, not suicidal, they will give them medication to try to stabilize them and then send them back out. That's not a long-term solution, and it's sort of trying to meet their demands of needing to maintain a fighting force out in the field while they're there.
I'm Cathy Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850 is the phone number. You can also send those emails with your questions and comments to drshow@wmu.org. Let's go to Priscilla in Cheverly, Maryland. Priscilla, you've joined The Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. I just wanted to point out, nobody seems to be mentioning that, you know, there can be medical reasons why somebody could become totally irrational and have a huge emotional change like that. I know of two different people that had undiagnosed diabetes that had that happen and that acted very crazy and were completely different than they had been before. And in one case, the person actually died of undiagnosed diabetes before anybody figured out what was going on. In the other case, you know, it was found out that that was what the problem was, and as soon as they were on medication, their emotional outlook completely changed again. So, I mean, there can be medical reasons, because, I'm watching the television, and his uncle was saying, you know, he didn't want to go into, the reason he went into psychiatry was because he couldn't stand the sight of blood. So it seems like a big, you know, there's a big emotional change for someone,
right,
to do this thing.
Although, Major General Eaton, I'm assuming that people who are in the military, at least from a physical point of view, are pretty well monitored physically for any kind of illness.
Cuddy, we're pretty complicated human beings, and there's a lot going on here that certainly I, as a layman, don't understand. So we do pass a rigorous physical. You take a physical every so often, every few years. We monitor all that we can monitor. We're complex creatures.
Paul, have you got anything to add to what Dana was saying about the processes for monitoring people psychologically and for evaluating them for post-traumatic stress and whether... And stress of any kind, whether we can improve our mechanisms for seeing when somebody who is under stress, and so many people in the military are, reaches a point that could be dangerous to their colleagues.
Your first line of defense is your chain of command. It's your team leader. It's your squad leader. Who these men and women know their soldiers better than anybody else, and they monitor their behaviors on a day-to-day basis. And the extended deployments have strengthened those bonds to create really a very powerful organization. So as long as our sergeants and our lieutenants and captains are informed and that they know the signs, that they know how to react to the signs, where the resources are to match against whatever signs they're picking up from their guys and gals, then this will be okay. But their first line of defense is our non-commissioned officer corps.
And what does the Army need to do now in the light of Fort Hood?
The investigation will inform how to adjust our processes, how to adjust our standard operating procedures. We will see some recommendations come out of this that will help us be better.
Retired Major General Paul Eaton, Senior Advisor with the National Security Network. Dana Priest has been with me. She's an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Imam Yahya Hendi has been with me. He's Muslim chaplain at Georgetown University. He's also a Muslim chaplain with the National Naval Medical Center. Thank you all so much for joining me for this hour.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
We've been discussing the investigation at Fort Hood in Texas. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm, and thank you all so much for listening this hour.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.